going to begin to get today's lecture at what seems like a peculiar place, perhaps, but there is method to the madness, as you will appreciate as we get through it. We're going to start with 2 Kings chapter 12. 2 Kings chapter... I'm sorry, not 2 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 12. My fault. 1 Kings chapter 12. This is the situation after the death of Solomon. We read that Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. I think we have to take a look and just start right here and take a look very carefully at what this term all Israel meant. Does it mean what we think it means, or does it mean something else? Now, we find that there was a complaint levied by the leaders of the people that had come, that Solomon's rule had been very grievous, his service very heavy upon them, and they're asking Rehoboam, what is your policy going to be like? Are you going to be like your father, Solomon, or are you going to be different? Now, Rehoboam chose to follow the advice of the young men rather than of the wiser heads, and he gives them an answer, which, of course, is that he would even make it tougher on them. Notice that when we come down here to verse 19, it says, Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day. Now, these are the same people that had come to him at Shechem to make their demands. Notice the rallying cry that is used here in verse 16. When all Israel, that rather ambiguous phrase again, saw that the king hearkened not to them, the people answered the king, saying, what portion do we have in David? Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now see to your own house, David. So Israel departed to their tents. Now who is this Israel that departed to their tents? Is it all the tribes, except for just the clan to which David belonged? No, because the very next verse makes it plain. But as for the children of Israel, which dwelt in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. So this Israel that rebelled against the house of David in verse 19 is not Judah. It is just the northern tribes. Notice in verse 20, it came to pass when all Israel... It becomes clear who this all Israel is. It means the northern tribes, not all the tribes. When all Israel, the northern tribes, heard that Jeroboam was come again, they sent and called him to the congregation and made him king over all Israel. If that term meant all the tribes, we've got something that doesn't make sense. How could he be king over all the tribes when the very next phrase says, there was none that followed the house of David but the tribe of Judah only? Obviously, we have all Israel referring to the northern tribes. And then, of course, as verse 21 makes clear, the tribe of Benjamin also joined themselves to Judah to fight against the house of Israel to bring the kingdom again to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. Now, we are struck here with something that's very strange. When a group of people decide to secede from a nation, they don't take the name of the nation with them. If they get up and walk out, that's not what happens. When the South walked out on the North, they didn't take the name United States of America with them. They had to design a new name. Or in Nigeria, when a group of Nigerians walk out of the country of Nigeria, they couldn't take the name Nigeria with them. They chose a different name, Biafra. Or when East Pakistan decided to separate from what was West Pakistan, they didn't continue to call themselves Pakistan. They chose a new name, Bangladesh. You see, this is the pattern that we find. So we have a very strange thing happening here. We have a situation where the people walking out keep what seems to be the name of the whole unit. Now, why is that? Well, there are two reasons, of course, why it happened. Because among the ringleaders of those that walked out, you had Ephraim and Manasseh. And Jacob, inspired of God, when he blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph, said let my name, Israel, be named on them. And so that was something that had to be fulfilled, is that Ephraim and Manasseh had to carry the name Israel. God had prophesied that that would be the case when he had Jacob, whose name was Israel, bless the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. But there's also a practical reason why it happened. There's also a practical reason why it happened. And if we take a look, if we turn on the slide projector at this point, we take a look and see what the situation was at the time when Saul died. Saul was king of Israel. As you're going to have it presented to you today, he was the only human being to rule a unified kingdom of Israel. The only human being to ever be king of Israel in the sense of being king over all the tribes under that name. Because after his death, the kingdom of Israel split into two kingdoms. A kingdom of Israel in the north, under the rule of Saul's son Ishbosheth, and a kingdom of Judah in the south, under the rule of David. Now, those of you that are in the historical geography class, recall we went over this yesterday. But since not everyone was there, let us briefly review that particular point. 2 Samuel, chapter 2, it tells us that when David went up with his household to Hebron, 2 Samuel, chapter 2, verse 4, the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David to be king over the house of Judah. Now, it mentions in verse 8 that Abner, the son of Ner, who was captain of Saul's host, in other words, his commander of the armies, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Machanaim, and made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, his own tribe, and over all Israel. So there again we have proof that the term all Israel does not always mean all the tribes. Because otherwise Ishbosheth is over all the tribes and David's over Judah. Something doesn't add up. It means the northern tribes. We have a double kingdom. The Israelites have been split up into two competing kingdoms. Israel in the north and Judah in the south. Now, it's not surprising that Ishbosheth is ruling a kingdom called Israel. That was the name of the original kingdom. And he is the son of the original king. He has the right to retain the name. It is Judah that has separated itself. Judah has refused to continue to accept the leadership of the house of Saul. Judah has chosen to go its own way, choosing a new leader. One that they feel is better, more competent, and has the blessing of God. And so Judah has separated itself, choosing David for its own king, and so has established itself as the kingdom of Judah. And we are told in chapter 3 in verse 1 that there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. Now if we were to look at this in terms of diagrams, we see the situation that originally there was one nation called Israel under one king by the name of Saul. But upon Saul's death, we have two kingdoms, the original name being kept by the tribes in the north because they followed the son of Saul, who was Ishbosheth, and the kingdom in the south being called Judah because it was the tribe of Judah only that followed David. At this time, the tribe of Benjamin was in the northern kingdom because the house of Saul came from Benjamin. But now we have a situation where after a period of warfare between the two kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel finds itself without a king. They have no leader. Because what happens in chapter 4 is that two of Ishbosheth's captains, not his commander-in-chief, but two of the lower-ranking individuals, conspired against him and assassinated him, hoping to curry favor with David. I can understand their motives. They were part of a kingdom whose power was getting weaker and weaker. The rival kingdom of Judah, the power was getting stronger and stronger. They could see the handwriting on the wall. Judah was going to take over Israel. Judah's king was going to take over and replace Ishbosheth anyway. Well, then what would happen to the top administrators who had served Ishbosheth? They would all be displaced. They would go on the unemployment line. Because David would continue to use the administrators that he had become used to using in his own kingdom of Judah. So they were going to jump ship while there was still time. They were going to transfer their loyalty to David and Judah and hope to secure jobs in the new administration that was surely coming. And so they acted in this fashion, not knowing David's character, but they put Israel as a nation into a bind. They now had no ruler, and these were very dangerous times. And so it is not surprising what we read about in the next situation in chapter 5. 2 Samuel chapter 5. Then came all the tribes of Israel. Wait a minute, all the tribes of Israel? All 12? No, there's no need for the tribe of Judah to come to David, as we will see. It must mean, again, the northern tribes, including Benjamin, to Hebron, and they spoke to him. And they told him that, look, you used to be our military leader. You used to go out under Saul's authority and lead us against the Philistines. And God surely showed he was behind you and was blessing you. And so it says in verse 3 that all the elders of Israel came to the king. He's already king. You see, he's king of Judah. To Hebron. And King David made a league or alliance with them in Hebron before the Eternal. And they anointed David to be king over Israel. Now, does this mean that the two kingdoms were put back together again under one single name, Israel? Well, it's very clear that it's not, if we just continue to read. It says they anointed him to be king over Israel. And in verse 5 it says, in Hebron he reigned over Judah for 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. That he ruled as a king over two separate countries for the period of 33 years, making his capital at Jerusalem. And so we see, as in this slide, that Israel acquired a king to replace the slain Ishbosheth, but they continued to have a separate identity. In the north, it was the kingdom of Israel, now with David as the king. And in the south, it was the kingdom of Judah with David as a king. Now, how do we know that this is the sense of which we should take chapter 5, verse 5, that he reigned for 33 years over all Israel and Judah? Well, I think if we go through the material, we will see that the separation was perpetuated. But this separation is not something that was obliterated. Now, I'm not going to take some of these scriptures in chronological order. I'm just going to take certain selected scriptures as illustrative of the continuing division between the two kingdoms. Notice, first of all, in 2 Samuel chapter 24. 2 Samuel chapter 24, we have an incident where David committed a grave error of judgment. When he enumerated the military men of his kingdoms. Now, of course, Satan, as we read in the companion account, was the one who inspired David to do this. And, of course, there was a horrible penalty that the people had to pay because of David's breaking of this provision of God's law. But notice what it says here in chapter 24. That the anger of the Eternal was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them through Satan's agency, to say, go number Israel and Judah. And when Joab eventually carried out the assignment, and he presented the figures to David, notice how they were presented in verse 9. Joab gave up the sum of the number of the people to the king, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men that drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000. You see, they are given as separate censuses for the reason that they are separate kingdoms. It was the most logical thing to do. That's why, as it said in verse 1, he instructed them to number Israel and Judah. You have this perpetuation of separation. Notice again that we're dealing with two separate groups. When we come to the matter of Absalom's rebellion, 2 Samuel 19, Absalom rebelled against his father David and won away the affections of the people of both kingdoms, and David was essentially left with only his own personal Praetorian guard, made up primarily of Philistines, as well as some men who chose to be loyal to David. And David had actually had to flee from Jerusalem, to flee for his life, to get out of Absalom's way. Now, eventually it came to a military confrontation between David and Absalom was killed. The people had gone off, they had abandoned David, they had chosen to follow his son Absalom, making him their king, and now they were left in a lurch. They had followed the wrong candidate. Their leader was now dead. We come in chapter 19, then, of 2 Samuel. You know that Joab had to kind of give some straight talk to his master David about his continuing to weep after Absalom being very demoralizing to the people that had followed him so loyally. And then we find that because of Joab's, you know, strictures, in verse 8, that the king arose and sat in the gate, and they told it to all the people, saying, "Behold, the king does sit in the gate." And all the people came before the king, for Israel had fled every man to his tent. And all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king saved us out of the hand of our enemies. He delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines. And now he has fled out of the land for Absalom. And Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now, therefore, why don't we speak a word about bringing the king back?" Now, it says all the tribes of Israel. Does that mean all or a restricted all? Well, it becomes very clear. Because whoever this all the tribes of Israel are, they are expressing themselves of a mind to be willing to invite David back formally to resume his leadership over them. And after this happens, notice what happens in verse 11. King David sent to Zadok and to Abiathar, the priests, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing that the speech of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house?" So once again, it is established that all the tribes of Israel must mean the more restricted sense. It must be a reference to the northern kingdom of Israel, the 10-tribe northern kingdom of Israel. That it's Judah that is strangely reluctant to formally invite the king back. And David's more than a little upset about it. After all, he's kin to Judah. How come they haven't even made their intentions known when the tribes of Israel, to whom he is not related, have already invited him back? And he goes on here in verse 12 with his message that is to be brought to them. He says, "You are my brethren. You are my bones and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king?" Now, as it says in verse 14, he bowed the heart of all the men of Judah, even as the heart of one man. So they sent this word to the king, "Return, you and all your servants." So they shamefacedly said, yes, we'd like to have you come back, please. We're sorry that we were laggard in this respect. But notice now what happens. very interesting little incident that is preserved for our admonition. Verse 15. The king returned and came to the Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to conduct the king over Jordan. They wanted to make a big ceremony out of it. Have a very elaborate ceremony of escorting the king back across the Jordan, and as a way of indicating they were accepting him back as their leader. Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjaminite, which was of Bahurim, hasted and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And he was 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. Now, it's interesting that Shimei falls down before the king as he was come over the Jordan, verse 18, and says to the king, "Let not my lord impute iniquity to me, neither do you remember that your servant did perversely in the day that my lord the king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take it to his heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned, and therefore I am the first this day of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king." So he's a Benjaminite, but he calls himself part of the house of Joseph, the northern kingdom, you see. Now, he had a reason to be in the vanguard. When David had been fleeing from Jerusalem, he stood up there watching David go out and cursed him for having done that. And so he's very much afraid now that his life is going to be forfeit. So he's trying to make amends. But what the point is, I'd like you to notice, is that Benjamin is in the northern part. It is attached to the northern kingdom, even under David. Because that's the way the man who's a Benjaminite describes himself, as a member of that northern kingdom. Okay, but as they are about to bring the king across the river, notice that something rather untoward happens. Notice this later in chapter 19, 2 Samuel 19, verse 39. All the people went over Jordan. And when the king was come over, the king... Well, let's just skip that. Let's go to verse 40, sorry. The king went on to Gilgal, and Himham went on with him. And all the people of Judah conducted the king, and also half the people of Israel. You see, in the honor guard, so to speak, escorting David across the Jordan, he has a very heavy representation from Judah, and a smaller one from Israel. Behold, all the men of Israel came to the king, and they said, "Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away, and have brought the king and his household and all of David's men with him over the Jordan?" And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, "Hey, look, don't get upset about it. It's no big deal. What are you getting yourself out of joint over? You know, after all, the king is near of kin to us. That's all. There's no big thing in this. We're not trying to put you down by outnumbering you and the number of people we have here in the honor guard. It's just that he's near of kin to us. So what are you getting so upset about? I mean, have we gotten some sort of special favor from the king because of this? Has he given us some special portions? Have we eaten at his cost? Or has he given us any gift?" And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, "Hey, we have 10 parts in the king. So we have more right to David than you. Why are you despising us that our advice should not have been first in bringing back the king?" And it says, as a result, the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. They really got into a long, drawn-out quarrel over this thing. Now stop and think for a minute. If there had been real harmony in the kingdom, would this have happened? Would such a seemingly trifling matter have been the cause for such tremendous anger on the part of both the men of Israel and the men of Judah? Obviously not. It shows you that David, in ruling over these two kingdoms, had not succeeded in effectively uniting them, recreating any real unity. It was simply a matter that he was king over two separate nations, each with its own very definite identity. And the very strong separate identity that each preserved got in the way. It got in the way of their better sense. And both groups got carried away over this very trifling incident. But notice where it led to, because the argument, you know, waxed so hot. Chapter 20. There happened to be there a man of Belial, in other words, a man of a very wrong attitude and spirit, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite, and he blew a trumpet and said, "We have no part in David, neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." Doesn't that sound familiar, that phrase? Yeah, we looked at it in 1 Kings chapter 12, when after the death of Solomon and Rehoboam giving the very poorly chosen answer to the men of the northern tribes who had come to ask for some relief, they raised the same sort of cry. It's as almost as if from this day until more than a generation later, this has become a rallying cry for the northern kingdom, that they were always feeling this sense of grievance. "So every man of Israel went up from after David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah clave to their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. Civil war broke out between the two kingdoms." Now, David was able to put it down rather quickly, and Sheba, of course, was killed. And the breach was again temporarily healed. The breach was temporarily healed. Notice when we get after David's death that we move into the time of Solomon, that Solomon is likewise king over a double kingdom. A double kingdom. And again, we can look into more recent history for similar analogies. When Queen Elizabeth died, the first Queen Elizabeth died in 1603, her successor was the King of Scotland. He became the new King of England. He was king of both England and Scotland, but he didn't make them one nation. He was James the First of England, and he was James the Sixth of Scotland. They were ruled as two separate entities. They had two separate parliaments, and they were not united until almost 100 years, well, more than 100 years later. This is the situation, that after the death of Saul, as son Ishbosheth, David is ruling two separate kingdoms, maintaining separate administrations in both, as we've seen some evidence of in his census of the military. Solomon also perpetuated the double nature of this kingdom. In 1 Kings chapter 1, 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 35, where you're given this statement, well, let's back up to get the whole thought. Verse 32. "King David said, 'Call me Tzadok the priest and Nathan the prophet and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada.' And they came before the king. The king also said to them, 'Take with you the servants of your Lord and cause Solomon my son to ride upon my own mule and bring him down to the Gihon spring. Let Tzadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him there king over Israel. And blow you the trumpet and say, God save the king Solomon. Then you shall come up after him, that he may come and sit upon my throne. For he shall be king in my stead. And I have appointed him to be ruler over Israel and over Judah." I think the wording is very strict and to the point. Over Israel and over Judah. That he was going to be king over both kingdoms. Notice in chapter 4 of 1 Kings, where we have a description of the organization of Solomon's kingdom. We have the various administrative districts that are enumerated here. It opens, of course, in verse 1 by saying that Solomon was king over all Israel, But it's talking again about the northern kingdom, 1 Kings 4, verse 1. It's talking about the northern kingdom of Israel that Solomon was king over. And then it begins to enumerate the districts. And we come down to find out that there was one separate division for Judah. There was one separate division for Judah, as opposed to 12 divisions for Israel. And notice in verse 20 it says, Judah and Israel were many as the sand which is of the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and making merry. And in verse 25, Judah and Israel dwelt safely, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, from Dan even to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. So here let's look at the summary of what we've seen. We see, recapitulating, that Israel was one nation under the rule of Saul, that when he died, the majority of the tribes, the northern tribes, followed his dynasty in the form of giving allegiance to his son Ishbosheth, while Judah chose to follow David, who was bone of their bone, flesh of their own flesh. That with the assassination of Ishbosheth, the people of the northern kingdom were in a bind. They didn't have a leader. They knew that David was blessed of God. They knew that he was a successful military man. So they came to him in Hebron and requested that he would be their king as well. And David accepted and then continued to rule as king of Israel, as well as maintaining his rule as king over Judah. That in the days of Solomon, Solomon succeeded David as king over Israel and over Judah. But that after his death, because it was God's will, Jeroboam became the ruler over the northern tribes, the tribes of Israel. And Rehoboam was left with Judah only, with one important difference. That this time, the tribe of Benjamin attached itself to the southern kingdom of Judah. The vast majority, anyway, did. And we'll have reason to look at that in historical geography class, of some of the physical realities, geographically speaking, that helped to influence that, that the majority of Benjamin became allied to the southern kingdom of Judah. But I think you can see why, when the northern tribes walked out of this dual kingdom setup, they retained the name Israel, because it's the name they had always had. It was theirs by right. As part of the unified kingdom of Saul, it was theirs. And because they retained their loyalty after the death of Saul to the family of Saul, they retained the right to the original name, Israel. Judah had to select a different name for their kingdom when they separated in order to have David as their king. And then when David became their king, he perpetuated the name of Israel throughout his life. Solomon perpetuated the northern kingdom's identity as Israel. And so when the northern kingdom walks out of this dual arrangement, they are simply retaining the name they have every right to retain. It is not surprising that though they are the ones who rebelled against the house of David, that they were fully entitled to retain the name of Israel, and thus fulfilled the prophecy that God inspired Jacob to give when he blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, that his name Israel would become indelibly imprinted upon the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, in the few remaining minutes I've got, I'd like to begin actually the next lecture, and then I will complete that next time and try to squeeze in the one on Solomon by scaling that back considerably to get us back on schedule. Let us take a look and see what the internal nature of David's kingdom was like. Remember, a king had two functions to perform. This is what the people had asked for when they asked Samuel for a king. The king was supposed to be the leader of the people in war, and he was supposed to be their judge. Okay. Now it says in 2 Samuel chapter 8, 2 Samuel chapter 8 is, you might consider it sort of a summary chapter of David's kingship. It lists all of his major wars, his major military conquests, which we will consider by the by. And it also summarizes his administration in verse 15. That David reigned over all Israel, and David executed judgment and justice unto all his people. Now that seems to be a redundancy, but it's not. Let's take a look at the Hebrew words. The Hebrew word that lies behind the King James translation, judgment, is the word mishpat, M-I-S-H-P-A-T. The Hebrew word that lies behind the King James translation of justice is the Hebrew word tzedakah, T-Z, an E written above the line, D-A-K-A-H. The reason the E is written above the line is because it's a half vowel. It's only there so you can pronounce T-Z-D. Otherwise, without a vowel, there's no way you could pronounce T-Z-D. Your mouth couldn't get around it. And so they stick in a half vowel to make it pronounceable. Tzedakah. Tzedakah. You pronounce it as if you're trying to say them without a vowel, and you barely hear the vowel. Now, what is the difference between mishpat and tzedakah? Mishpat refers to the literal letter of the law. Remember, God gave Israel a very comprehensive law, and it provided certain specific penalties when these laws were broken. Mishpat refers to the literal letter of the law as provided in the written law of God. Well, why then would you need anything else? Because God in his wisdom knew that you would. Remember, we read in Deuteronomy chapter 17 that Moses instructed the people saying that if a decision involving a case is too difficult for you, you shall go and take it to the Levitical priests and the judge of that day, and they will show you the sentence of judgment, and they will teach you how to apply it. Now, they're not talking about a situation where they can't decide whether a person's guilty or innocent. Because then you don't have to teach the sentence of judgment. You just have to say, hey, we find the man guilty. You had trouble deciding, we say he's guilty, carry out the letter of the law. Then there would be no problem. But obviously, if they have to show them the sentence of judgment, if they have to teach them how they arrived at it, we're dealing with things that sort of fall between the cracks, that aren't specifically covered. For example, it says in God's law that if a man has a slave and he puts out the slave's eye because he mistreated him, he puts out his eye, or he breaks his tooth, the slave is entitled to his freedom. But what if instead of putting out the eye or breaking the tooth, he mangles his hand? Is the slave entitled to his freedom? Well, the law doesn't talk about mangled hands. It talks about a tooth and it talks about an eye. What's the answer? Now, somewhere or other, it must have happened that some other part of the anatomy was damaged and some slave said, hey, I wonder, does this give me my freedom or doesn't it? And so the intent of the law had to be abstracted from the literal instruction, looked at, a decision made, yes, this would obviously be what God intended. He wasn't just interested in eyes only or teeth only. He was interested in serious bodily injury, maliciously, you know, perpetrated on a slave. So any such serious bodily injury would give a slave the right to his freedom. In other words, they look behind the literal letter of it to what the intent of the law was, so they can have equity. The equitable intent of the law can be applied. This is what tzedakah is. And that's why I think in the Revised Standard Version, they use a different word. I think they use justice to translate mishpat, and I think they use equity to translate tzedakah, to show that it's the equitable intent of the law which is meant by the Hebrew term tzedakah. Literally, the Hebrew word tzedakah means righteousness. That's its literal meaning. But in Hebrew, Hebrew doesn't have as many words as English. And in Hebrew, one word frequently has a wide range of meanings. You have to know which meaning is intended in this particular passage, and not just blindly translate it the same way all the time. And so it is obvious from the construction and from the way it was applied in David's reign that this is the intent, the equitable intent of the law is what is meant by tzedakah. Now, the Bible preserves for our instruction two situations which David faced where he had to apply tzedakah as well as just mishpat. Because it's not just a case of something not covered in the law. Sometimes a crime is committed. There's no doubt the crime has been committed. It's a crime specifically mentioned in the law. A penalty is specifically assigned in the law for that crime. But to just apply the penalty would not really carry out true equity. Equity would not be served. If we say justice would not truly be served by carrying out blindly the penalty for the infraction. And so because of the special circumstances, something has to be done with the penalty. It neither needs to be made stiffer, a harsher penalty than provided for in the law must be exacted to achieve equity, or, because of the special circumstances, the opposite. You have to soften the penalty because of the special circumstances. That's what equity sometimes requires, to have true equity. Now, in our system, we don't always have that leeway. And that's why sometimes a judge gets in a situation where he even speaks from the bench that, you know, I wish I could do more against this defendant than the law permits, because he certainly deserves more than just what the law prescribes. But I am bound by the legislation and must just administer the penalty called for. Now, they do have a little more discretion the other way to soften, but they don't have the capacity to increase the severity. And that is, of course, a defect in our law. In Israel, they could go either way, because the interest was justice. And so if justice is served by making it harsher, the judge could do it. If justice would be truly served by making it less harsh, the judge could do that as well. It was a better system. Now, what I want you to do for next time is to look at the two specific cases that are mentioned in the scripture dealing where David sat as the Supreme Court, having to render a decision. 2 Samuel 12. The matter really at hand is David's adultery with Bathsheba. What in the world does the parable of Nathan have to do with the real case? See if you can see where the two relate to each other. Nathan's parable about the rich man with many flocks and herds and the poor man with a small wee lamb, how does that apply to David's situation with Bathsheba? And then notice where you think Mishpat comes into David's decision and where Tzedakah comes in, remembering what Tzedakah means. Looking at the special circumstances to either, in order that justice can be served, to make the law harsher, or make, rather, the penalty harsher, or make the penalty softer. Where does it come in? And then in 2 Samuel chapter 14, you have a very interesting long tale of a widow woman and her particular problem. In order to see the relationship, you have to read chapter 13 first, which deals with the rape of Tamar by Amnon and the subsequent murder of Amnon by Absalom. Then you look at the tale of the widow woman, which is supposed to be connected to Absalom's murder of his brother. And see, can you see how they relate and how it leads David to cancel the penalty of the law against his son Absalom and invite his son to come back? Try to see if you can see the relationship of that parable to the literal case that was really at hand. And then we'll talk about both of those cases next time.